Why do people still text and drive, even knowing the danger? Matt Richtel will be here to talk about his new book, A Deadly Wandering, A Tale of Tragedy and Redemption in the Age of Attention.
The technology that beckons us is getting more powerful. There are more options to use behind the wheel.
Is football worth the pain? Mark Edmondson will join me to talk about his new book, Why Football Matters, My Education in the Game.
It can, you know, make you brutal or angry or egotistical, or all those things are dangerous. But I would say it's dangerous to live without stimulating timoffs too.
Alexander Alter will join me to talk about what's going on in the book world this week. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Joining me now is Matt Richtel, author of A Deadly Wandering, A Tale of Tragedy and Redemption in the Age of Attention. Hi, Matt.
Hi, thank you.
This book grew out of stories that you did for The Times, Pulitzer-winning stories, about a particular case of texting while driving. Tell us what happened on that morning in September 2006.
Yeah, last day of summer, 2006, September 22, and a young man named Reggie Shaw, 19 years old, is driving to work at 6:30 in the morning, so it's dark. And even though it's the last day of summer, there's freezing rain. And he's going 55 miles an hour and kind of periodically crossing the yellow divider. And the last time he crosses the yellow divider, he clips a Saturn carrying two men, and their car spins around, and they are violently struck by the car behind Reggie, which happens to be a farrier, a horseshoe maker, carrying 2 tons of horseshoes and horseshoe making equipment, and the two men are killed instantly.
And then the driver is Reggie Shaw. Who is he?
Reggie Shaw is a remarkable young man. He's
how old was he at the time?
He was 19. He is a good guy with a little bit of checkers in his past that make this case interesting. An all-American kid in many ways, and he stops 100 yards down the road. His Chevy is unscathed, virtually. He's unhurt, and he says he can't remember what happened. He thinks maybe he hydroplaned. This is what he tells a trooper, a Utah State trooper named Bart Rindelsbacher, who arrives to see this carnage, and the trooper suspects something else.
Now, isn't this an easy thing to track down? I mean, there are timestamps on messages and the like, right? I mean, isn't there kind of a black box in every case of texting while driving?
You would think that, right? You would think that now, and it's not even true now. It certainly wasn't the case in 2006. And this trooper suspects that Reggie has been texting because on the way to the hospital to get a blood test, pull his phone out and begin to text with one hand. And the trooper says, I realized he was a one-hander. I think something's going on. And to your question, he spent literally months, in fact, more than a year with his cohorts doing a kind of Sherlock Holmes investigation into trying to get the phone records. They didn't get the right carrier, then they didn't get the right number. And then lo and behold, as Reggie has hunkered down with a lawyer saying, I didn't do it, I don't remember doing it, I didn't text and drive, they discover that Reggie had texted 11 times in the minutes and seconds around the wreck, and then they discover the mystery number of who he was texting to. So it all unfolds sort of like this true crime kind of thing.
I'm assuming the terrible truth is going to be he was texting presumably something.
It could not have been more innocuous. It was a young woman he was sort of kind of dating but just friends with. Remember, Reggie is a kind of an innocent young man, a Mormon who's always dreamed of going on a mission. So dating is not very hot and heavy. It's just sort of getting to know each other. And these are, hi, good morning, how are you? Boom, crash, fatalities.
So, you know, texting and driving obviously has become a major problem and an issue, and there's all this awareness of it now. But we're talking 8 years ago. What was the awareness like at the time of the problem?
Yeah, I mean, the awareness was creeping up, but there wasn't really taught and talked about. But I think in some ways it's what makes where I wanted to take this book was to ask, now that we have awareness, 96% of people know this is a major problem or say it in polls, and yet a third, more than a third, still do it. Why is there such a disconnect between awareness and behavior? And in Reggie's case, he was a good kid. He well knew that he should not be looking down in his lap in freezing rain in the dark going 55 miles an hour. Why the disconnect between attitude and behavior? And so much of the book, as you know, is spent looking into Reggie's brain and ours to ask, why can't we help ourselves?
Before we go into the cognitive science, which is so interesting, I just want to go back to your reporting on this story and how it grew into a book. You work out of the San Francisco Bureau of the New York Times and write often about the intersection of technology and life. When this happened, did you immediately start covering the case? What brought you to this story?
When we were writing about texting and driving for our initial series, we thought maybe it would be one story in July of whatever the year was, 2009, and we did a big blowout story. And I can tell you that I and my editors said, this is a journalistic perfect storm. We've never seen this kind of reaction to a story that was an overview of the issue of distraction behind the wheel. And in the course of spending 6 months on that kind of behemoth, I had a notebook full of stories. And one of them was this guy I'd heard about called Reggie Shaw. And I went to Utah and we included it sort of in our pantheon of about a dozen kind of big stories over the course of that year. And he always stayed in my mind, but it wasn't just him. The characters in this story, which take place in northern Utah, while not singular, are kind of extraordinary for their openness and their ordinariness and the fact that they became a prism through which to view this idea of attention. Then, and I think as well as now, we look at the idea of attention very differently depending on our perspective on life. How much are you supposed to attend to your spouse, your kids?
Right.
You know, this community and the things they had been through and the people all were looking at this and wrestling with it. And so it just stuck with me. I didn't plan to do a book and it wouldn't go away in my mind.
Right. You'd written a series of articles about this case. How did you decide that it needed to be expanded into a book?
Two things stuck with me. The people, not just Reggie, but the people who hunted him and their own, a victim's advocate who suffered terrible abuse, a prosecutor who had suffered abuse inside a church, a prosecutor who wouldn't take the case because he had killed someone while behind the wheel. All these characters were sticking with me, coupled with a question I could not get away from. Here's a nice kid. Could have been me. Could have been any of us. Tons of common sense. What was going on in his brain? And over the years, between 2009 and 2 or 3 years ago, as this stuck with me, I began to watch the science evolve. And I saw the neuroscience get to the point where they were making real headway in understanding our relationship to technology. And I thought, well, if I could marry this human drama with this really compelling new science and say something new, that was a book I couldn't walk away from.
One of the interesting things is that in the modern car, there are more and more screens being introduced into the actual, you know, into the car itself. You have the GPS view, the, you know, that you can switch it to rearview mirror. Everything on the, you know, stereo system is now a screen. There are movies that you can watch in your car. How is texting different from this, and sort of why is that all okay and seemingly expanding, but...
Well, first, don't get the public safety advocates started. You know, somewhere just that question made someone keel over because it's many of these activities are not that much different. You're looking away, you're manipulating something, cognitively you're distracted. What the folks who deliver this technology will say is, well, look, we've seen accidents go down, so it can't be that bad. But what the public safety advocates will say is two things. They've gone down all over the world and gone down way less in the United States, even as we've invested billions in car safety, billions in airbags, billions in wider roads. So first off, these things are an issue. Second off, one word for you, and it's money.
Right.
There is a belief by, say, the automakers, that this is what consumers want. It gets very hard to tell the distinction between the marketing that gets things glorified and what consumers want right now. I would say that most safety advocates would tell you texting might be might be the worst among these activities, but the act of looking down and even sometimes not looking down and manipulating a device and being distracted by it is leading to many, many deaths on the roadway. Distracted driving is one of the leading causes of death, maybe the leading cause. I get that number and the drunk driving confused sometimes, but we're talking about an issue that not only is not going away, but the technology that beckons us is getting more powerful. There are more options to use behind the wheel.
I'm glad you brought up drunk driving, because it's an interesting parallel, it seems, in two ways. One, in how is it different in terms of how dangerous it is versus texting? And then secondly, the awareness and campaign against drunk driving, how does that compare with awareness and the campaign against texting today?
Yeah, two great questions. Certainly texting is worse than drunk driving in one respect, and not as bad in one respect. But the one respect where it's worse is if you're looking down, you're blind. And if you're looking down for 3 to 5 seconds, you're on a highway, you're blind for the length of a football field. So make no mistake. I mean, unless you're blind drunk, you are actually blind by virtue of not looking at the road when you're texting. Some of the other things vary. I also do not want to diminish drunk driving. While we have made great inroads, and I'll connect that in a second to what we're doing with texting, it still is a major problem. The public safety advocates worry that we've sort of peaked out on bringing that number down, although they have done a wonderful job, and they've done it through two things that are instructive when thinking about texting and driving. They've done it through public education, and they've done it through tough laws that are very well enforced.
How tough are the laws on texting right now?
That's exactly the issue that we're coming to right now. 45 states outlaw texting and driving, and I think it's 10, forgive me, 10 or thereabouts, that require hands-free phone when you're talking.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the issue that public safety advocates will tell you. Even though those laws are better than not, the attitudes and the behaviors are still at a huge gap, as I described earlier. So what's going on? Why aren't these working? Well, one thing they'll tell you about drunk driving laws is they had to get very tough before attitudes got in line with behavior. You were afraid you would lose your license. And I think if you ask people to search their souls about why they don't drink and drive, it's a pretty close answer. I don't want to hurt anybody or myself, and I don't want to lose my license. I mean, that's a big part of the behavioral shift. Right now, the texting laws are fairly low in terms of the amount of money you pay. It's a veritable slap on the wrist, the public safety advocates will say.
More of a fine than a crime.
More a fine than a crime, that's well said. And in some places, it's a secondary offense, meaning you don't even get pulled over for the texting. You get pulled over for some other offense like swerving or a tail light out, and then they notice that you're simultaneously texting. Here's the other issue. Psychologically, the laws right now, the public safety advocates will tell you, are confusing both for the driver and law enforcement. Let's take law enforcement. Is that person texting? Are they dialing? Are they calling up Pandora? Are they using the map? So these are hard things. For the consumer, it's a very hard distinction to draw. I've been talking to psychologists about this. Well, what exactly can I do with my phone? How am I supposed to make sense of the distinction between dialing and texting? I mean, it does, even as you say it and think about it, it seems like a nonsensical distinction. So right now, I think the thought among public safety advocates is the first wave, if it might be making nips and tucks in awareness, we still need to do something else. What that something else is, I'm cautious about being too prescriptive given my journalistic stance, but I think people are taking really hard looks at that.
When we think about texting and driving, you know, the sort of dark villainous view is that, you know, it's some teenager and they're typing out, you know, LOL or whatever. But the truth is a lot of people use MapQuest or another map device.
Yep.
They use it for their music now rather than the stereo that's in the car itself. And these are viewed as kind of okay,
right,
even part of the modern driving experience. But presumably, the effect on the driving is the same.
Yeah. I mean, when you are, again, when you're looking away, when you're manipulating something, when you are distracted by the effort to look at something in your lap or to manipulate something, the effect is negligible. You are still at a huge, huge risk. So you're right, and the phones are getting ever more powerful. It's not just those things, though. Remember that it's also now a spate of incoming information, and this is where the cognitive stuff really becomes very pronounced. You get a ping, and that ping could have been a text. Now it can be an email. Now it can be a status update on Facebook. Now it can be an Instagram. I mean, you're really looking at a mountain of potentially extremely relevant, or you perceive it to be relevant, social information, and that is hard to walk away from.
Right. It has this kind of drug-like effect of, like, someone wants me, something's there for me.
I mean, the
what could it be?
Yeah, I think the most, for me, the most evocative image that I've come across in this book is to imagine your forebears, a caveman, a cavewoman, building a fire and hears the roar of a lion or feels a tap on the shoulder. Who among us could not turn around to see if that's a deadly threat or an opportunity? Maybe it's food, maybe it's a potential mate. That's wired more as deeply as any single cell organism thing you can imagine. So now you're in your car, right? And the phone rings. That is a proverbial tap on the shoulder from anyone, anywhere in the world. What chance do you have to turn away from that? And that is just layer one of the kind of lure I get into in the book. But when you start to add up these different things, the mere interaction with a device gives you a kind of adrenaline rush,
right,
a stimulation, what they call a dopamine squirt. So you get accustomed to getting a little rush.
It's that drug-like effect.
Drug-like effect. In its absence, you feel bored. So now suddenly you're habituated to it. You're behind the wheel. It's kind of boring. I know how to do this. You have this really bad control group in that you've never gotten in a wreck before, so it couldn't possibly happen this time. And maybe you start to send a note just so you can get one back, just to get that stimulation cycle going again.
We should mention that the sound engineers who come up with these pings and alert noises, they know what they're doing. They're very brilliantly seductive sounds.
Some of my favorite quotes in the book are from these neuroscientists who are saying, look, this industry makes its money when you are connected. And they are brilliant, and they have figured out the sweet spot where you can't turn away. Why would they want you to turn away? They're either getting fees or advertising. I mean, to be clear, this is not a diatribe against technology. This stuff, one of the reasons it's so amazing is because it is so useful. It's just the question is, can that utility, can that social primitive need in effect hijack us at times when it is counterproductive or even deadly?
Well, it could not be a more relevant topic to so many of us. Matt, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
The book again is A Deadly Wandering, A Tale of Tragedy and Redemption in the Age of Attention by Matt Richtel. Alexandra Alter joins me now to talk about what's going on in the publishing world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new?
So this week, the Association of American Publishers released they produce these reports on how the book business is doing, and they were looking at the first 5 months of this year. Adult nonfiction and fiction is down 3%, or almost 4% compared to last year. But children's and young adult is once again the category that's kind of carrying the entire industry. It's up 30%.
Wow.
Yeah, this is a trend that is not going away. And I'm starting to wonder if some of the reason that the adult sales are down is that more adults are reading young adult and children's books.
Switching over, dumbing it down. No, I didn't say that. I mean, it's interesting. Vanity Fair just came out with its new establishment list, and John Green is very prominently on that list.
Of course. And yeah, John Green and Veronica Roth joined the Forbes list of the most highly paid authors this year for the first time. They estimated that Veronica Roth made something like $17 million and John Green made something like $9 million. So they were in the ranks for the first time this year as well.
I think the debate, though, continues to rage about what this means. There was a piece online by Chris Beha of Harper's Magazine and novelist who just wrote Arts and Entertainment, sort of about reading the full Henry James canon, and he tied this to, or sort of in opposition to, the tendency to read YA.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not just the debate has been a lot about adults reading YA and whether that's appropriate and whether we're overlooking great books that we should be reading. There's also the question of, you know, teens who, you know, traditionally when I was a teenager and a lot of us, you know, would read novels that we weren't supposed to read that were a little too sophisticated or scary or old, you know, for adults.
Right.
And if, you know, perhaps that's not happening anymore either. So there is a question. Of course, there's so much sophisticated and great literature that's out for teens and children now. So you can certainly support a lot of it. But it is a question of at what cost when you see the adult fiction sales are down.
Read it all.
Exactly.
How did nonfiction do?
Nonfiction was bundled actually with fiction, and so in that category it was down about 4%. And then in terms of formats, this was sort of surprising. Paperback was up 6%. That's been a sort of struggling format as people are switching to ebooks. They're, you know, priced comparably often, and if you know, the people that used to wait for the paperback to save money will now just often buy the ebook.
I guess what it has in common with the ebooks is really price and people's ongoing sensitivity to price.
Exactly. Right. And ebooks, which, you know, were growing at double digit numbers for a long time, were sort of leveling off, but they were up 7%. So not a huge amount, but sort of still sort of ticking up a little bit.
Video didn't kill the radio
star. Not yet.
Okay. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Edmondson joins me now. He is the author of Why Football Matters, My Education in the Game, reviewed this week in the book review by Roy Blunt, Jr. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Your book is reviewed alongside another book called Against Football, which perhaps puts your book a little bit on the defensive. Why did you decide to write a book about why football matters?
Well, I'm interested in education, and as a professor, I'm interested in education by books. But I'm also interested in education by sports, which I think of as a kind of education of the spirit.
And you teach English at the University of Virginia and have written a book called Why Read? So it's interesting that you took on what would seem like a very different subject. But what is it that's important that football teaches?
If I could go back to my classical side a little bit, Plato's very interested in educating people, and he wants to educate their minds, and I do too. But he thinks that people need to be not just spirited, that is, passionate and intense, but in control of their passion and intensity. And football, at its best, helps people to tap into their spiritedness, and it also helps them to channel it. We've seen that at its worst, football doesn't do very much for the channeling part.
You started off playing football as a child. Your experience was not immediately positive. Can you tell a little bit about your time as a football player and what you learned?
I mean, there may have been more maladroit guys going out for varsity football in America in 1968 than I was, but I'm not entirely sure. You know, I was kind of fat and kind of slow and pretty nearsighted. And, you know, those things gradually changed, except for the nearsighted part, which continues on to this day. Got a little faster, a little stronger, a little more confident, a little more spirited, a little more able. And I took pleasure in the game eventually. And that was good in itself. I liked it. And I think it probably washed over into other areas of my life where I badly needed a little head of confidence or a little head of conviction.
You write about the fact that, you know, kids need to toughen up in order to play football and question whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. So where did you come out on that question?
Well, you know, Tim Green, the great football player, great lineman, says, football teaches you how to get up. You get knocked down on virtually every play. You fail on virtually every play. And, you know, you got to get up and you got to play some more. And I think that's a lot of what life is about. Most of what you do doesn't work out at all or doesn't work out as well as you had thought, and you have to get up and do it again. Other sports can teach you that, I have no doubt about it, but football is very literal. You literally do get knocked down on virtually every play, and you literally do have to stand back up again.
I mean, I guess there are some kids who, either whether they were fat or too skinny or too slow, start off in football, have a hard time, and whereas some kids then, you know, toughen up and become ultimately part of the team, others feel humiliated, upset by the experience. It kind of becomes a scarring childhood episode. Is that a sign of their failure, or is everyone not meant to succeed in football?
I may be too optimistic about this, but I think when young people fail at things, when I failed at things. There is, and I write about this in the book, there's no better opportunity to learn something about who you are and what your resources are and what your limits are. And maybe what you figure out is football wasn't the game for you, but hey, tennis was, or sports aren't the thing for you, though. Though I think everybody should use his or her body in a way that's pleasing and intense. I think that, you know, if people feel scarred by that forever, it's a little bit on them to go back and rethink it and learn what they can out of it and see if they can't use it for as ammunition or resources for the future.
How did you feel when your son decided to take up football?
Well, in fact, I felt good, and I felt maybe a little bit too good, because my son has some of my intensity but my wife's athletic ability. And so he was a star football player. And I was so gratified by that that, it was a little over the top, I'm afraid. And I thought I was beyond all that stuff. So it was interesting to come to terms with, you know. It was kind of me replaying my own inadequacies at the game, which was still there at the end, and seeing them redeemed in him, and then having to think about what it meant to be a father who was looking at his son for some kind of recompense and, you know, make some adjustments based on that.
What did you learn?
I learned a dose more of detachment. A sense that, you know, he had his life and I had mine, and he wasn't living his life for me. And though I was living some of my life for him, I wasn't living all of it for him either. And there was room for a little bit of detachment there. He eventually left the game, and when he did, I was quite happy for him. He seemed to want to do some other things, and that was the right thing to do.
And did you feel like he learned similar things from his own football experience? When you look at, you know, what you learned as a young football player,
I think he learned toughness and focus, and I think he had his intensity confirmed by the game, and I think he still likes to sit down and watch a game with me from time to time and talk it over. So that's a good thing.
What aspect of the intensity was worrisome to you?
You know, whenever you got somebody who is rekindling this thing, or kindling this thing that Plato called timos, it can be very useful. It can help you get a book written or work on a scientific project or start a business, but it can also overflow the measure. And it can, you know, make you brutal or angry or egotistical, or all those things are dangerous. But I would say it's dangerous to live without stimulating timos, too.
Well, I mean, some of the arguments against football in recent years, of course, have been about the physical danger and the potential for brain damage and the difficulties with concussion. Did that play into your wanting to write this book? Did you feel like football needed a kind of a defense?
You know, it's my book on football is a defense, but it's a pretty ambivalent one. I'm distressed about head injuries, and I'd like to see all done about them that can be done. I want to see the kids on the in high school and in Division One and Two and Three with the best possible helmets and the best possible coaching and rules that make concussions less likely. But, and this is perhaps on the controversial side, you know, there always have been people who in their 20s are willing to take unusual risks for great rewards. And those people aren't just athletes. They're soldiers and sailors and Marines. And they're also poets and painters and business people who are willing to go all out and risk their future lives in order to achieve some kind of, you know, joy, glory, intensity, and riches when they are young. So I'm okay with that. It's not me. I don't think I would do it. And if my son did it, I would be somewhat distressed. But I do support the right of people to do that, and the right of the rest of us to stand by and on admiration for what it is they're doing.
You teach English at the University of Virginia, as we mentioned, and presumably you have football players from the University of Virginia's football team as students. There's so many stereotypes, negative often, about student athletes, but do you find that players bring something to the classroom?
Well, this is a D1 school, and I teach fairly advanced courses in literature, and it will come as no surprise to anybody who knows Division I schools that I haven't had a football player in class for, I would say, 15 or 20 years. I had Bob Greasy's son in my class. Most football players are not academically ready to take on the rigors of the hardest majors at a university like the University of Virginia. They have different values and different aspirations. I will say that I spend some time with the football players, but they play basketball at the gym, and so do I, sort of, and I get to know them and like them very much. They're very thoughtful, very down-to-earth, very grounded, and interesting to talk to about football and about some other things too. So I'm glad that I know them. I'm not sure that universities should be feeder systems for the NFL. I have some real questions about that.
What is it that troubles you?
Well, the tail wags the dog at a certain point. You know, we bring in students who really aren't students and really look at this as a way to make it to the NFL. We take the student body and get them interested more in the Saturday football game than in the Friday night or Thursday night library, maybe. And also, I do have questions about the young men who play the game with the idea that they're going to go to the NFL. They're not, most of them. A very small percentage is going to go to the NFL. And I heard recently that of those who do go into the NFL, they last between 2 and 5 years, and 70% of them have financial trouble when they leave the profession. So, you know, I have a lot of questions about it, although overall I do endorse the game.
Just going back to the question of perhaps what a student might learn in English class, in an English class at the University of Virginia versus what they might learn on the football team, are there any interesting commonalities between the two?
Well, you know, the people who wrote the work that we most admire often had a tenacity that was not unrelated to the tenacity that athletes have. I'm teaching Herman Melville pretty soon. And Melville threw his whole heart and soul, as you know, into the writing of Moby Dick, and he was exhilarated when he was finished, and he told Hawthorne as much, and the book failed. Nobody read it. And yet, you know, carved in the back of Melville's desk, and we found it after he died, were lines that he quoted from Schiller, "Hold fast to the dreams of your youth." And he tried to do that. You know, he wrote some wonderful stuff, even after Moby Dick, like Bartleby. And so there's a tenacity there and a determination, which Melville didn't get from football per se, but he did suggest that, you know, a whaling ship was his Harvard and his Yale. And maybe what he got on those whaling ships was comparable to what somebody can get on a football field.
Mark Edmondson, you make some very powerful pro-football arguments. The book, again, is Why Football Matters by Mark Edmondson, reviewed this week in the book review by Roy Blunt Jr. Mark, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Hi, this is John Williams, an editor at The Times, and I'm here with Greg Coles, who has bestseller news. Hey, Greg.
Hi, John.
What's new on the list this week?
On the children's side of things, three of the four lists have new entries. Starting on the middle grade list, there's one new title. It's Mike Lupica's Fantasy League, a new novel from Mike Lupica at number 9 on the list. Also, one new title on the picture book list. It's a book called Mix It Up, new at number 4, by the French illustrator Hervé Toulet. He's an artist and illustrator who does these really kind of appealingly spare books. His big breakthrough hit here was called Press Here, and that's also on the picture book list at number 6. It's been on the list for 158 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah. So now he's got a new one called Mix It Up. It's almost like art theory for kids. It's kind of a book of colors and how they mix together.
Cool.
And then on the young adult list, there are two new titles. Rick Yancey's The Infinite Sea is new at number 4. That follows up his book, The Fifth Wave, probably starting a series.
Right.
And then at number 8, Jandy Nelson has a book called I'll Give You the Sun. So that's the kids' side of things.
What about the adult lists?
There are four new titles on the adult nonfiction list. Down at number 14, a woman named Caitlin Dowdy has a book called Smoke Gets in Your Eyes. That book, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, has the wonderful subtitle, And Other Lessons from the Crematory.
Whoa.
Kind of makes you look at that smoke in a whole new light.
Yes.
Caitlin Dowdy is a young undertaker in Los Angeles. And over the past few years, she's started a web series and spoken to the public and to her customers. She's really trying to demystify the whole process of death for people and funerals and to encourage kind of a DIY aesthetic in the funeral business.
Right. Lo-fi burial.
Yeah. I mean, really, she says, oh, you don't need a casket. There are natural burying grounds. You can just put the body in a hole in the ground. And yeah.
Really old school.
Really, yes, like medieval school.
I guess the web series is popular. It seems like sort of a grim book to hit the list so quickly. She must have kind of a following.
Yeah, she does. And it's almost like a shtick that she has. I mean, she, I think, is still in her 20s. And so kind of a young woman undertaker. She just plays up the morbidity thing.
Right. Yeah, easy for her in her 20s.
You go to her website and it's like, meet your mortician.
Yeah. Very funny.
Then at number 11, Lawrence Wright's new book, 13 Days in September, which looks at the Camp David talks back in 1978. That hits the list at number 11. That was reviewed on our cover a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Then at number 5, the anti-corporate activist, the no-logo activist Naomi Klein, who hit the list with an earlier book called The Shock Doctrine, has a new book about the climate, corporations and climate change, called This Changes Everything, sort of laying the fault for climate change at the feet of corporate greed. Mm-hmm. She was involved in the People's Climate March that happened in New York.
Right, sort of a big book launch for her in a way.
Yeah, exactly right. And then at number 4, Rush Limbaugh's brother, David Limbaugh, the conservative author and commentator, has a book called Jesus on Trial. It sort of follows in the long tradition of Christian apologias. It is going back and explaining how he came to his faith, why he believes what he does, and laying out the case for the truth of the Gospels, and the truth of the Bible.
And it debuts pretty high up on the list.
It does. It debuts at number 4. There was some talk in conservative circles that it probably should have been on the list. Last week, the people who compile the Times' list say, you know, look, we stand by our numbers, and from the stores that we track, it just wasn't there, but it is this week. And David Limbaugh has made the list before. This question of whether the Times you know, has a bias against conservative books, I think if you look back through the records, it just doesn't stand up. There are often a lot of conservative books on the list.
Yes, absolutely.
So,
well, the numbers don't lie, so.
Yeah. Then there are 5 new books on the fiction side of things this week in hardcover. Down at number 15, Jonathan Kellerman, a longtime contributor to the list, has written a book with his son Jesse Kellerman, who had previously written 5 standalone novels. Mm. It's the first time the two of them have collaborated. They have a book called Gollum of Hollywood that is the first in a planned series that they're doing. Mm. It's partly about a murder in Hollywood, but the Gollum in question is, in fact, the Gollum of Prague.
Wow.
So it's kind of a supernatural murder mystery.
Okay.
Yeah. Then at number 12, Sarah Waters, the British novelist who writes historical novels, often with lesbian themes in them, has a historical novel with a lesbian theme called The Paying Guests. She's really a terrific novelist. This is the first time that she's made the list.
Oh, that's great. I know she's popular in Britain.
She is, yes. And
she's developing a bigger following over here, which is nice.
Yeah, and that book hits the list at number 12. Then a debut novel at number 9, the leader and sometimes sole member of the indie band The Mountain Goats, John Darnielle, has a novel called Wolf in White Van. It's on the long list for the National Book Awards Fiction Prize, and that book hits the list at number 9. Then at number 6, Richard Castle has a new book in his Deadly Heat series featuring the New York detective Nikki Heat. This one is called Raging Heat, new at number 6. Mm-hmm. And at number 1, Ken Follett concludes his Century trilogy with a book called Edge of Eternity. It brings his characters right up into the 1980s.
These were really weighty books. I think all of them were
oh yeah, they're like
looked like a trilogy each one.
Exactly. They're about, you know, 600 pages each or if not more, and they kind of take their characters all the way through the major events of the 20th century. It's kind of a Forrest Gump type thing.
Right. And I think Follett did buy the book just a couple of weeks ago. So if people missed that, they can find it online on our website.
Yeah.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, John.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.